Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, and you're probably wondering when you always listen to the show, has John lost his mind and started new music? There's a reason for this new music today, because I want to let everybody know that Suspense Radio, this is our 100th show, so we had to do something a little different, so I decided to be a little bit cheesy, put a little Cool in the Gang on there, who is actually touring right now with Van Halen. You may be able to catch a show, even though Van Halen canceled some, but that's all beside the point, because I'm your host, John Robb. This is Suspense Radio. This is our 100th show. It is 2 hours extended edition today. We have four wonderful authors coming up for you. First, we're going to have Alicia Singleton. She's going to be on to talk about her book. Later, we're going to have award-winning author P.M. Terrell. We're going to also have Nancy Atherton, and we're going to have author C.E. Lawrence. All coming to you today in this two-hour extended edition of Suspense Radio, and it all begins right now, with more suspenseful music, like we always have. So again, everybody, this is our 100th show, Suspense Radio. We want to thank everybody for listening to us. We have over 37,000 listeners, and we continue to grow. It just gets better and better every week that we do this. We're going to take a break after this week, so make sure you check the Suspense Magazine page. Click on Suspense Radio to see who's coming up, when it's coming up, and everything else. But right now, we're going to go right into our first guest. Like I said, this is award-winning author Alicia Singleton. We're going to talk about her book here, which is called Dark Side of Valor, which is out now. It was out on February 7th, so we're a little, you know, getting her. But that's good that we were able to get her here on the show. So, Alicia, I want to thank you so much for joining us. How you doing?
I'm great, John, and I have to tell you, I was grooving in the kitchen to Cool in the Gang celebration, so.
Well, you know, I mean, it's not very suspenseful, but it's a celebration, 100 shows, so I had to do something a little different. But, hey, Cool in the Gang is good enough for Van Halen, and I still have this CD, Emergency. I can't help it. I love that CD. Then that's the way
wow.
It's going to be on the show.
There you go. Congratulations to the 100th show. That's such an accomplishment.
Yes, well, thank you very much. And congratulations to you on your book here, Dark Side of Valor, and all the accomplishments you've been able to build up. So, Dark Side of Valor, tell everybody a little bit about the book, a little behind the scenes, so they can kind of understand a little bit about who you are if they've not read your books.
All right. Well, Dark Side of Valor is about a former teenage runaway turned child advocate named Leva Freeman. She stumbles onto some political secrets when she's called to Washington, D.C. to serve on a subcommittee, and those secrets endanger her life. She gets kidnapped overseas and has to depend on a tall, dark, handsome stranger to bring her back home, but he has some secrets of his own. So that's the basis of Dark Side of Valor.
So basically, you know, we're talking cat and mouse, suspense, run, intrigue, the whole thing kind of wrapped into one. And we're also probably, you know, we have some romance mixed in there. So you get a little bit of everything that's going, you know, that's going on in the book. When you decided, you know, when you're sitting down thinking, I always try to figure out, you know, authors like chicken for the egg. Was this something, was the story something that you would come up with, or did you really like this character that you wanted to write about? Kind of how did all that kind of come about?
Actually, John, when I come up with my story, I'm a little of a weirdo. You know, I look at things and my mind starts going and stories come out of just crazy things that I see, you know. But Dark Side of Valor started off being a totally different novel. It was supposed to be about a woman who was in a foreign country and she wanted to escape back to the United States. And I started looking up research for runaways from foreign countries, and runaways in the United States and homeless teens in the United States just kept popping up in my research parameters. So I read some articles and I looked at some of their life stories, and through their life stories, Dark Side of Valor, you know, sort of morphed into something else. So it's like a combination of those two entities, and I came up with the novel from that.
So then if you had Lila Freeman, who's your main character in the book here, and she's sitting in front of you right now, and you're able to interview her, what one question would you want to ask her to get a little bit more information about who Lila Freeman is?
One question I would ask her probably is, are you crazy going into crack houses to save save anyone? Number two, how did you get kidnapped overseas, and what were you thinking when you woke up, you know, in a Middle Eastern country overseas with nothing except the dress that you had on? So those probably would be the two questions I would ask her.
And what is like one of the one things that your character or that your fans would probably be a little bit shocked to hear about Lila Freeman and about maybe who she is outside of the books?
Probably that she is, even though she's courageous, she's very courageous, and she jumps in head first if someone's in danger, she has a fear of letting people down. And it's a fear that cripples her later on in the book to a point that she might not make it through. So that's one thing they might not figure out about Lila, because she jumps in head first and then she gets herself into trouble, ergo Dark Side of Valor. And, you know, she doesn't think too much when she sees someone in danger.
And, you know, since Dark Side of Valor is your first book that, you know, came out with, and it's kind of subtitles like Zane Presents, I was kind of wondering a little bit about what exactly is Zane? Is this something that's going to be a series that's going to be ongoing? Do you have, you know, are your characters going to go forward with you in your writing?
Actually, Zane Presents, Zane is an author, and she has an imprint in Simon & Schuster, and she was the one that accepted the book for contract. So Zane is actually an author, yes. But there are two spinoffs to Dark Side of Valor that I want to work on after I get finished the novel that I'm currently pulling my hair out over right now.
Well, that's never a good thing. But that's the life of a writer. That's the thing that you got to do when you're sitting down behind the computer and you're working or wherever you're at, and, you know, things just aren't coming to you. A lot of writers, and I've been to a lot of conventions, and I met a lot of them, they don't have a lot of hair.
You're right.
None of them have a lot of hair.
I'm sure Rogaine loves us. I'm sure they love us.
You know, so the journey of Dark Side of Valor, because, you know, this is something I always say, is that the first book you write is the easiest book to write because you had your whole life to get it done. So you got it all ready to go. But now that you're with Simon & Schuster, you're with one of the big six publishing houses, and now you have all this pressure, and they're like, okay, here's your deadline. You got to get this one done. Is that, do you think that, that my statement is true? Because now you have the deadline, and now it's like, can you write a book in 6 months?
You know what, John? You're absolutely right. It took me 5 years to write Dark Side of Valor, and I wrote it 4 times over, cover to cover, you know. So it took me a while, and I'm not a fast writer because I want to get it right, and I feel a lot of pressure trying to get the one that I'm working on now out. So you're absolutely right. It is the easiest to write. I don't know what's going to happen in years to come as far as the time frame, the 6 months that you know, that takes out the rest of my hair, the little bit of strands that I had left.
Right.
So we'll have to see what happens.
Now, since it took you so long to write it, when you're going, because, you know, you always have your main character, and that's Leela in there, and then you got the dog, you know, you got some other secondary characters, but it's the secondary characters that seem to be the ones that kind of fulfill the book, make it full. Is there a secondary character in your book that surprised you when you were writing that they ended up having maybe a bigger voice than you anticipated them having when you were first sitting down and had this whole, you know, concept going out?
Yes, there is. There's one character, and her name is Aunt Lou, and she's outrageous. I got her when I was shopping at a grocery store, and she's outrageous. She lives in the jungles of the Congo, and she's been a world traveler for years, and she's back in the Congo, and she's sort of like a medicine woman, and she has a T-shirt. She's about, I guess, maybe about 75. She wears T-shirts, Mean People Suck T-shirts, in loud neon colors, big hoop earrings with basketballs hanging down from them, high-top sneakers, and kente skirts.
Mm-hmm.
So she's very outrageous, and I loved her character, and she was just going to be a little adjunct in the book, but she ended up being there for several chapters. So I got a kick out of writing her. So, yes, she did take over that section of the book.
And is that something that when you're sitting there and you're going and you're just kind of having so much fun and they just kind of keep popping in, that when you're done, when you're writing and you go back and you reread it, that's when you realize that those kind of characters did come out that way and that those are probably the ones that you get most of the emails about, are those secondary ones?
You're absolutely right. You are absolutely right.
Jesus, I'm like 3 for 3 with you on absolutely right. This is wonderful. This never happens.
I know,
with me, especially
synced.
Talking with a woman.
We are synced, John.
Especially when I'm talking
music.
With a woman, I'm never right.
Well, I'm very easy to get along with, so.
So that was something. So that is kind of true. I mean, when it's not until you really go back and really reread it that you find out that these characters, you know, come through that way. It's one of those nice surprises.
It is. It is. And I think that it leads into making series books that maybe you didn't think about beforehand, when the character becomes so developed and you get so engrossed and they have another life and you're like, wow, I could spin this off into something else. So it's a win-win, actually.
Yeah. I mean, now we have a lot of authors that listen to the show, and of course everybody right now is always wondering, and the big thing that's going on right now is, okay, you know, do we need an agent, you know, do we need to go with the big six publishers, can we self-publish, what's going on with your journey and what you had to do taking 5 years to get the book? How was it with you, and, you know, what exactly did you have to go through in order to find Simon & Schuster or have them find you? You know, how did all that dynamic work out? Because that's a huge accomplishment right off the bat.
Well, John, actually, people see the glory, but they don't know the story behind what it took. I started my writing career back in 1994. It took me 18 years from then until the book was published to actually hold the book in my hand from a major publisher. It took 16 years to get a contract. Now, I, you know, started off and I was educating myself, taking my writing courses, conferences, everything, and shaking hands with editors, agents, going to the conferences. You know how it goes. And, you know, couldn't get anybody to pick me up, let alone an agent. So my husband and I self-pubbed Dark Side of Valor in 2002. And we got a lot of good press and everything, and I happened to get an agent about a year later. And she put the book out, you know, and to all the major publishers, and no one would take us. So I guess that was about 2003 to 2004 when she was trying. So from 2004 until 2 years ago, you know, all that time, well, actually,
right.
I count from 1994, that's how long it took me to get a contract. So it's been a long, long, long time.
And now the one thing, and this is the one thing that I always like to tell authors, it's like they get their contract, they think everything is great, but the one thing that they need to realize is once you wrote the end in your book,
mm-hmm.
it was literally just the beginning, because now you're having to do something that a lot of authors aren't comfortable with. That's
mm-hmm.
why authors write and writers write, because they don't like to be out in the spotlight. They don't like to have to go out and now market themselves. But now that's something that you had to do, and that's something you have to learn. Was that
yes.
difficult for you to be able to say, okay, now go to the public and start talking to them about your book, and you're like, I don't really, I just want to write.
Actually, you know, I'm the weirdo in the bunch. I love public speaking. I love getting out there and talking to people. Before I was a writer, I was a registered nurse for 12 years. And my last job in nursing, I had to go to hospitals and teach doctors and nurses about the medical modalities that my company had for their patients. So I was used to getting in front of people and talking and, you know, getting in there, shaking hands, you know, and everything else. So it was just, it was okay for me. I like going out and talking to people, shaking hands, cracking jokes, you know. So that part wasn't bad whatsoever. And my mom and my dad, they were business people throughout their lives. So getting out there, marketing, you know, making your product the best it can be and then putting it out in front of people, that wasn't difficult either. So it was, and I knew I had to do it. If you want to be a New York Times bestseller, you have to get the marketing in. So, you know, that's my goal one day. So I knew I had to do it. So, you know, you do what you have to do to get where you have to go.
Right.
So,
But the scary part had to be that even though you were talking with people about your work and things like that, now you're having to talk to them about your actual writing. And
mm-hmm.
that can be a very scary, daunting thing for people, because it's like, you're nervous. I mean, it's your first thing. Are they going to like it? Are they not going to like it? What are they going to say? And this and that. And you just have to put yourself out there. And luckily, all the reviews came back great, and you didn't have any I mean, so that's got to be very, like, a big weight lifted off your shoulders, I guess you want to say.
You know, it is, John. And I have to tell you two short things. One, I've been waiting so long, and I said, you know, I was at the point where you just get, I don't want to say frustrated, but you're just at the end, and it's like, look, it's going to go
mm-hmm.
like this, and if you don't like it, I don't care, because I know there's some people that do. And then
right.
another thing, to confirm what you were saying, I got the pleasure of being on a panel or a two-person talk with Christine Lincoln. And years ago, she won these big prizes to get her degree, and she was on Oprah in 2020, and she toured the country. And I thought it was a mistake. I thought they had put me there by mistake, and they were waiting to snatch my name down and put me all the way at the end of the hall. I didn't think I was going to be with her. And she came in the room. She was so nervous. Her hands were trembling. You know, her paper was shaking, and she didn't want to get up and speak. And she had been with Barbara Walters, and I was thinking to myself, wow, you know. So it does happen to even the most prominent authors. You're right.
It happens to any. You see a lot of authors, and they're very, I guess, just uncomfortable maybe in their own skin when they're out there having to be with people. And that's why it's very important for authors today to realize if you have to do it, take a public speaking course or something.
Yes.
because you're going to have to do it. If you want to be successful, you cannot rely on Facebook.
No, you can't. No, you can't tweet your way through it.
No.
And Toastmasters is great for anyone who, you know, who wants to take public speaking. Toastmasters is a fantastic organization, too.
Yeah, you can't tweet your way to a bestseller.
That's
what we're trying to say, right? Yeah.
Exactly.
I mean, even though those things are good tools, people still need to realize how difficult it is, and that's just one of the, you know, funny things.
You're right.
But now,
you're right.
And you're talking to us from Maryland, so I have to think that you're probably a big Ravens fan.
My husband is a big Ravens fan. You know, I'm not too much into football. Dare I say that? Hopefully.
Wow.
I know.
Well, okay. Hold on. So I have to totally just hold on. I gotta rip up those line of questioning. Okay, let's move on. So you're not. But the Orioles are doing well. Well, but now. So what do you do? So then, outside of writing, you know, what's one of the things that you kind of do hobby wise for fun when you're not, you know, when you're not writing?
I love to travel. If anyone says road trip, I'm in the car. I love to go to historical things or artsy things, museums, concerts. My husband and I, for some research, we went down to a former rice plantation down in South Carolina and toured all around, and that was very interesting. It was so nice, though. So those kind of things I love to do, as opposed to going to a Ravens game.
Now, if I ask you this question, if there's one book, any book ever written, no matter what it is, and you could be the author of it, which book would it be?
All of Edgar Allan Poe's collection, his whole collection. If they could say Edgar Allan Poe it was my pseudonym, I would love it.
So I'm thinking you saw The Raven.
Well, that's the one thing I like, the mascot, that it correlates with my favorite author. So.
And that was a movie that, like, my wife, she didn't enjoy it too much. She thought it was a little too gory. I thought it was a fascinating movie. So someone being a huge Edgar Allan Poe fan, what did you think? And being from Maryland, I guess that's another reason why you're such a huge fan, because he lived there. That was part of the story. I don't know if they quite got it right, of course, how he died. I think that was kind of fictional. Maybe he was poisoned. But there's got to be a lot of mystique for you to be able to go around and see a lot of things living in that area.
You're absolutely right. And you know what? I'm sorry, John. I thought you were talking about the Raven, the mascot for the football team. I didn't know you were talking about the movie.
Yes, the movie The Raven with John Cusack.
I'm still on the football a couple of questions
ago. I ripped all those questions up.
Okay, all right. Now I'm out of the woods. But his life was just so phenomenal, and actually, there's a big petition. They were trying to get his home demolished here in Maryland. So, and that was a big hoopla. But there is quite a number of things here, his grave, of course, and his home and things, and they have this big festival every year of his death, and it's sort of cool. It's really cool to be around that kind of energy for him.
Well, again, and I want to just remind, we're talking here with, and we're almost kind of wrapping up time, we're talking with author Alicia Singleton, and her book is Dark Side of Valor. And you can find Alicia on the internet, and she is at aliciasingleton.com. And there's a lot of different things that you have on. I mean, you know, it's starting to build, and it's getting built up. And that's something that you're doing. Is one of those things, you know, like the website that you're trying to build, is that going to eventually, you know, do you have kind of a way of interacting maybe more with fans or things like that? Do you have a lot of more things going on with it?
You know, I have some things that I want to do that are in my mind. I'm not a technical person, and the majority of the things that are on the website, minus the design, I've had to learn how to put them on there. And I'm the kind of person who thought that they were ready to do Skype chats, and my son said, "Ma, you don't even have the software downloaded. You need to have it downloaded before you can do a chat." So,
right.
It's taken me a little while to get what I want to on the website, but you're right. I am slowly working on getting more interactive things with the readers on there.
Well, I'll tell you what. I want to thank you so much for coming on. We have just gone, you know, blown right here through 20-so minutes. And the book, again, is Dark Side of Valor. Like everybody heard, there's going to be some more series possibly down the road after your next standalone, which I take it is probably going to be out around the same time next year in February. Typically, they stick you with around the same month. And we've been talking with author Alicia Singleton. So, Alicia, I want to thank you so much for coming on with us.
Thank you so much, John. It's been a blast. It's such an honor to be here with you.
Well, thank you again, and you enjoy and have a great weekend, and keep us up to date on things that are going on, and we'd love to maybe have you back on with the next book in that you have going out in the series, possibly.
Thank you so much. I look forward to it.
All right. Have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye.
So, again, everybody, that is author Alicia Singleton, and it's AliciaSingleton.com. The book is Dark Side of Valor. I recommend you go out and check this out. It's a little bit different kind of suspense. Thriller, romance, the whole kind of thing that's all put into one that we love as fans. That's what we love to see in a book, is those types of different genres coming together, webbed together, to be able to create a great piece of fiction. And that's something that I think all the fans would enjoy. So we're going to go ahead right now. We're going to take a short break. We're going to play an audio clip. Our first one here on our 100th show again of Suspense Radio. This is called Primacy, and it is by Joel Fishman, and it begins right now.
Hello, Suspense Radio fans. Here's an excerpt from Primacy by J.E. Fishman. The car felt sluggish, the muffler clattering along the street, taking every pothole to heart. As she slowed at a yellow light on Hempstead Avenue, Leanne looked around for police cruisers. Heck of a time to get pulled over. A dark blue Chevy Impala switched lanes abruptly behind her, and she recognized the driver. His face struck more fear in her than the police ever would. Could his presence on this street at this moment be a coincidence? Leanne shuddered. She turned left where she would have gone straight, and turned right where she would have gone left. She followed the most random path she could trace, leaving the main road, avoiding dead ends, easing through quiet residential neighborhoods with her muffler etching stripes into the blacktop. She came to a red light by a major thoroughfare in Rockville Center, and a block behind her the Impala slowed to a stop. There was no question that he was following her. She took a deep breath, and when a brake came in traffic, ran the red light with a dangerous left turn. Tires screeched, horns honked, the muffler shot sparks. She focused on the rearview mirror, made more random turns, and finally pointed the car back in the direction of her mother's house. But a minute later, he was on her tail again. She could see his face clearly, draped in a menacing grin, sending a message. Fear tightened her throat. She made a right turn onto Sunrise Highway and pulled across three lanes to the far left. She drifted along for a while at normal speed, the Impala never more than one traffic light behind her, the sound of the muffler grating her nerves, reminding her with each bump that she was heading in the wrong direction, away from her mother's house. Reminding her, too, that she couldn't outrun a donkey cart with her Honda in this shape. She barely perceived the Long Island Railroad commuter train gliding along in the distance. It was a mile away at least, parallel to the road on an elevated track, heading toward her. She made a U-turn at the next intersection, passing the Impala, so close they could spit at one another across the median. The grin hadn't left his face. As he made the same U-turn and continued to shadow her, she focused on the train. The next station was back near her apartment in Limbrook, half a mile now, she reckoned. If this had been the movie, she thought, she'd jump the tracks and run along the rails until her tires stripped off, and she hooked up to the train and let it drag her along to safety. But in reality, she was on the ground in a car that couldn't attain 40 miles per hour before going to pieces. In reality, the train was not only 3/4 of a mile behind her, but riding along a bed that was 20 feet over her grade. In reality, she was on the wrong end of a slow-motion car chase that didn't lend itself to movie cues. Still, there is a train. She had a sense that it might harbor her deliverance, and she knew where to find the station. 90 seconds, Leanne calculated. 90 seconds for the train to pull into the station and open and close its doors. 90 seconds to cross traffic, drive through the underpass, drop the car, and race up the stairs to the platform. Eyeing the train in her side-view mirror, she eased over to the right lane and drew to a complete stop at the green light with her hazards blinking. Impatient drivers laid on their horns, but she ignored them. She waited for the train to pull within a tenth of a mile, then floored the accelerator. The Accord groaned, then jumped through the red light and out into crossing traffic, barely avoiding collision with an oil truck. It fishtailed through the overpass and ground to an awkward halt at the base of the station stairs. As Leanne threw open her door, she could see the Impala careening through traffic. The casual flowing skirt that Mickey had fetched for her caused wind drag that she didn't need right now, slowing her down and wasting precious seconds as she struggled to take the steps two at a time, a stretch for her short stride under any conditions. She reached the platform as the train hissed to a stop. There was a delay before the doors opened, and she jogged toward the front, entering the first car out of breath. The seats were sparsely occupied, mostly by day laborers returning from early jobs, their cheeks freshly weathered by spring sunshine. She took a seat near the door facing backward, peering anxiously through the milky scratched glass of the train window, silently begging the conductor to shut the doors. The electronic indicator tone sounded and the doors finally began to slide closed, just as her pursuer reached the platform. She watched for him to sprint for it and disappear into the train's shadow. She guessed 3 cars back. There was a long pause. The doors reopened. The tone sounded, then they slapped closed. Leanne's stomach knotted. She felt certain that Vlad Gretsch had succeeded in boarding the train.
Glamour, celebrity, and murder. Whether you're looking for mystery or suspense, you'll find it all at Thriller Fast. Open to readers, aspiring writers, and published authors. Learn craft, meet top thriller writers, and enjoy New York City July 11th through the 14th. Jack Higgins, R.L. Stein, Lee Child, Karen Slaughter, Catherine Coulter, Richard North Patterson, John Sanford, and Wu, and more. Join them this summer. Find out more at www.thrillerfest.com.
Inside out, only God can inside.
welcome back from break. Again, that was the audio clip that you heard. It was called Primacy. It was by Joel Fishman. If you want to hear your clip on the air, all you have to do is email editor@suspensemagazine.com. Give you all the information you want, anything that you want to know about how to get your audio clip on the air. It's very easy. First, you need to create one or have one, and then email it to me. That's it. It's free. Get it on the air. It's no big deal. Let, you know, thousands of people be able to listen to your book. So read the best part that you can put out there to have people be intrigued. It's very simple. We do everything we can to help you guys market. So we're going to move on right now. We're going to go to our next guest. And this is the author of a book that came out called Silent Kills. Her name is C.E. Lawrence. The website is celawrence.com. Very easy. Can't forget that one. So, C.E., I want to thank you so much for coming on. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks for having me, John.
So, Silent Kills is out. You have a bunch of other things that you got going on. Tell everybody a little bit about the book, kind of the conception, how it kind of works out, and just some behind
sure.
the scenes.
Sure, sure. Well, it's the third book in my series of thrillers, Lee Campbell thrillers. Lee Campbell is a criminal profiler who works with the NYPD, and he, you know, is brought in on the cases which require a criminal profiler because there's very little forensic evidence. There is, in fact, no criminal profiler full-time on the staff of NYPD, which is interesting. But in my fictional world, there is. Well, they tend to call in, you know, because there's so many people in New York, they call in various people, like the man I studied with at John Jay. Dr. Schlesinger has worked with them, and, you know, a bunch of other, you know, occasionally they have people from the FBI who come in, but there is no full-time profiler. But so I invented one. So this guy, he works with the NYPD. He's a civilian advisor, so he's not technically a cop, so he doesn't get to carry a gun, which can lead to some trouble. And generally speaking, he's been called in so far in serial killer cases, and this book in particular, this is the third one. He is also chasing a serial killer. This guy, there's a bit of a twist. He is a vampire, or at least he thinks he's a vampire. And again, this is not an unknown disorder. It's a psychosis that has come up not only with men, but also with women. This killer drains the blood of his victims and drinks it. And he thinks he has this notion that it's going to help him to not die. And there was actually a countess, a very famous serial murderer who lived in Eastern Europe, and she was she would drain the blood from young girls and drink it. And she was also, like my killer, she was a sexually motivated sadistic serial killer. And but because she was a countess, she murdered hundreds and hundreds of victims before she was finally brought to justice.
Elizabeth Bathory.
You got it. Wow. You know your history. Wow.
Yes. Back in the 1500s. Very, very nice.
Yep.
Yes. She used to think that would make her young by bathing in.
Exactly.
In the blood of the young women. Yeah.
Well, she thought, I mean, there was a couple things going on. She allegedly thought it would make her young, and she probably did, but she was also obviously, she tortured them, and she was obviously a sadist and a sexual sadist, and my guy, you know, has a family history. I always go into a little bit into the histories of my killers and why they turned out the way they did, and this guy had a specific trauma in his childhood that led him to do this. And he's also a steampunker. So I introduced the readers to the world of steampunk. And I got into it last summer through steampunk music groups like Abney Park and Clockwork Quartet. And so I really got into it. And so I decided to set this in the world. You know, his world is the world of the steampunk.
And that's something that's very interesting, because when you're getting into a villain that is just so, you know, I guess you want to say deranged, I can't really think of a word, do you kind of have to take your mind into those places that it normally would never be to be able to create somebody like that? And it kind of makes it fun, because you're able to kind of do a lot of things that, you know, you weren't able, you know, you're not able to do, of course, in the real world. Able to create
absolutely,
fiction.
Absolutely. You got it exactly right, John. That is what I do. I can't stick to what everybody does. It's funny, I was at a panel with a bunch of very well-known thriller writers, and I think the moderator, Stephen James, said, do you get into the head of your killer and do you care what makes him tick? And everyone but me said, no, we just want him to be dangerous. We don't care. We don't care, you know, what the childhood was. We don't care how their mind works. I'm just the opposite. It was the study of criminal psychology that got me into this whole thing in the first place. And I'm very interested in how they think. And, yeah, I do kind of get inside their head, and consequently I have a strange, you know, I have a strange empathy for every single one of my killers, because I've given them these childhoods and these backgrounds where I know what happened to them. And it was pretty horrendous in most cases. So at the same time I want them caught, there's a part of me that really does, I suppose, identify and sympathize with, you know, why they turned out the way they did.
Right, I guess what it does is that it gives the readers, and we love Stephen James, and it gives the readers a sense of just more fulfillment instead of just throwing a character out there that's killing for no reason. Typically,
right,
serial killers have a reason. Most of them are not just total insane nutcases. There's some reason in their head that makes them do what it is. Even if we think it's crazy, it's not to them. And that's the part that you're able to do as an author, to kind of relay that to the reader.
Yeah, well, I try anyway. I certainly try. And the other thing that happens, and this is something that I wasn't entertaining in my own head until my therapist said, yeah, you think you get a kind of vicarious thrill out of, you know, writing about these people who were so outside the law? And I went, all right, maybe a little.
Yeah.
I think that happens. I mean, lately I hang around thriller writers a lot, and they're very happy people. They're very cheerful, they're nice, and I think it's because I think part of it is they get their rocks off, they get this dark journey that they write about, and then it's all out, and then it's like they don't have to, they've lived it on the page, and then they can have, you know, very normal lives. That's my experience anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. That is one thing. When people go, and whether they go to any of these conventions, they'd be able to realize that it's kind of like, yeah, Stephen King is not this evil person. He just writes about evil stuff. You know, that's just a big different thing. And most thriller writers are very easygoing, laid back and everything else. And I think a lot of fans are like, oh, you're not creepy. No, just like you.
Well, you know, I don't know. If you were to meet me, you might find me extraordinarily creepy. I can't speak to that. But I think that horror writers in particular are writing, you know, it's funny you mentioned Stephen King, who I, of course, admire and respect greatly. I think sometimes horror writers are writing about their own personal fears. I mean, I think
True.
It's interesting. I mean, I think on some level we're all, you know, R.L. Stine gave the most delightful acceptance speech last year at when he was, you know, the grandmaster for Thriller Fest for ITW.
Right.
And he stood up and said, we all are engaged in a sacred mission to spread more fear in the world. And everybody, of course, just fell off their chairs laughing. And it was a delightful thing to say, but on some level, he's exactly right. And I think that maybe a horror in particular is really fear-driven. And I think that Stephen King, perhaps, if he hadn't been a horror writer, would have been an extremely anxious person. It's just a guess.
I can see that.
Absolutely.
So
basically, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Finish your thought.
I was just going to say that I think that these darker forms of fiction, genre or otherwise, are ways for us to safely have experiences that we're going to have anyway. That we have these fears, and we know these people exist, and for a lot of us, you know, monsters live under the bed and this kind of thing. And so, I think that literature is a way to have those experiences in a safe way and actually make us feel better in the end. That's all.
Oh, absolutely. And like I want to do, I just want to remind everybody that we're talking here with author C.E. Lawrence and the book Silent Killed and Silent Scream. So it's a series that was going on, and I'm sure that it's going to continue your criminal profile, the NYPD Lee Campbell series, moving along. There's a lot of different things, and I like what you said about authors possibly putting what their fears are in writing, because when I had the opportunity and I've interviewed John Saul a couple times, one of the questions that I asked him was, I said, what scares you? You like to scare everybody else. What scares you? I can't remember the answer. I know that it was written down in that interview, but that's something that I just kind of thought of off the top of my head was, yeah, you guys are scaring the hell out of us. What scares you? So I'm going to ask you, what scares you?
Oh, that's such a good question. You know, it's so funny that you asked that because I had an experience last night. I woke up in the middle of the night. I'm living in a cabin in the woods in Woodstock. And half the year I live in New York and half the year I live in a writer's colony in Woodstock. And I woke up in the middle of the night. There was unquestionably a sound. And it was funny because I knew it was probably an animal, but what really terrified me was that it might be a person. And once I went around the cabin and turned on all the lights and locked all of the doors, I satisfied myself that it was an animal. And the idea of a bear or a raccoon or anything, you know, sort of rooting around my cabin didn't bother me. But the idea of a human being breaking into my cabin absolutely terrified me. So I guess I have to say I am afraid of evil people. I'm afraid of what people can do. You know, I'm afraid of. I guess I write about that because I genuinely, when push comes to shove, it does scare me. You know, the evil things that people seem to be capable of doing.
And like
more
a true thriller, thriller writer. You figured out it was just an animal and everything was fine. You jumped on your computer and you're like, nah, this is a scary person and they came in to kill and you started writing a scene.
That's right. Well, it's funny. I started writing about serial killers the first summer that I spent up at Birdcliff. I had written, I've written some Holmes. I don't know if you know that under the name Carol Bouquet, I have a couple of Holmes, Sherlock Holmes novels. And I have a mystery series of cozies, but I'd never written anything this dark. And I started it in my cabin in the woods, and that was the first summer I started writing this dark stuff. And when it's dark in the country, it is dark.
It is.
And when you hear these noises, and they're probably animals, probably raccoons, you hear these noises and you do start to think, oh, what are the chances of a serial killer actually coming to my cabin? And you can't. You know that the chances are remote, but then you start thinking about, you know, in cold blood, and you start thinking about, well, the chances of anyone coming to that farmhouse are remote, but they murdered the family.
Right.
You know? So you start thinking like that, you know. And I think that this my mother used to tell me. I had an old, she was very kind to me as a child, but she said one day she took me aside and she said, you know, I just think you have an overactive imagination. And it should have been that moment where I said, yeah, Mom, I'm going to be a thriller writer.
Exactly. That's the moment that you realize that your fears and your thoughts were going to be put on paper for everyone to enjoy and get scared the hell out of.
There you go. Then I can make some money out of this. You know, make money
right.
out of your flaws. That's what I say.
Exactly. And that's just one of the great things that you can able to do. You're able to create any world you want and have anything happen and have people read about it. It gives you a little insight about your brain, about how maybe you kind of think and create as a person. Writing is no different than music. It's no different than making art. It's the same thing, and people kind of forget that.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was just writing, actually, I just wrote an article for The Writer magazine that's going to be coming out soon. And I talk about that. There's a difference between the way visual artists think and the way storytellers think. And I really dig being around painters because for them it's like they just exist in the moment, in the present, and they're not and they have this very very different energy from writers, you know, and because it's not all about moving forward to them, you know. A painting is kind of this thing that just exists in the moment, and they're forced to be in the moment, you know, because of their work in a different way than we are. And there's no question that I don't have the personality of a painter. I mean, I'm not zen in that way. But it's really interesting to me. I think different people have slightly different personalities. But I do agree with you that the process remains very, very much the same in terms of creativity.
And you're with Kensington Publishing, and they're a great mm-hmm. publishing house. And they're one of those things. And what I've tried to figure out is, it seems that Kensington is starting to be one of those publishing houses that is loving thrillers and loving what you do, that's got to give you a lot of sense of enjoyment, too, to realize that you have a publisher behind you that just supports you 100% in your writing. And because you kind of get lost in the shuffle sometimes with some of the other ones because they're so diverse in what they do that you just kind of get lost.
Yeah, I agree with you. I do feel 100% supported by Kensington. They have been so good to me. And, you know, my editor, Michaela Hamilton, I can't say enough good things about her. She's just so... she's so supportive, you know. It's like having a BFF instead of an editor. And I've had plenty of editors, but I've never had one that I felt, you know, so committed and so personally invested. And it's funny because she said one time, we were at a Cape Cod Writers Conference last year, and she got up and she was one of the keynote speakers, and she said, "Well, at Kensington, we publish books that people want to read." And I thought that was so interesting. It was sort of a delicate way of saying, yeah, well, you know what, maybe Simon and Schuster have, you know, their, you know, la-di-da-di-da, but you know what, people are actually reading our books. I thought that was so cute. I mean, I'm not knocking Simon and Schuster. I'm just saying, you know, Kensington
right.
is one of the small, not one of the bigger publishers, but boy, they sure do treat their authors well, at least from my perspective. And you're right, they really are committed to thrillers and moving forward every day about it. Go ahead, you were going to say?
Yeah, well, I was going to ask you kind of about, like, the ebook thing, because you've been around and you've seen a lot of publishing changes, and you know the things that are going on. You came in, you know, Silent Screens came in with 2009, but you had books published before that. But 2009 was C.E. Lawrence and Silent Screens. So it was kind of at the start of the ebook thing. People really didn't know what was kind of going on with it. How have you kind of, you know, seen the embrace of it? Because we had Steve Barry on last week, and he made and he said something astonishing, which was 75% of his sales are now ebooks. I thought that was amazing.
Wow, that's interesting. It's funny. Steve and I were in that same panel that I was talking about when I said I was on a panel with some well-known thriller writers, and Steve was one of them. And that's the first time I had met him. I just wrote an ebook. Funny you should ask.
I'm in tune today. I got it going on with the guest today. I'm in tune.
Yeah, you're on a roll, John. You're on a roll for sure. Yeah, I just was asked by Kensington to write an ebook to help promote the next thriller, the next, you know, full-length thriller. So the next thriller that's coming out is Silent Slaughter. That's the title of it. And I have a really, really nasty killer in that book. So then they asked me to write an ebook. So I wrote an ebook that will be coming out, I think, right after Silent Slaughter. And that's about an 80-page novella. So not a full-length, but it's a novella, and it's also Lee Campbell. You know, it's also he's after a serial killer in that one as well. So I think the ebook thing is really, I have to agree. I mean, I don't know what percentage of my sales are ebooks at this point, but I think that none of us can turn our backs on the importance of it. And I think the internet has been a real two-edged sword. On the one hand, it requires that you keep up with what's going on in a tremendous way. But on the other hand, it's a tremendous marketing tool. And if you can just, you know, I think all of us have to get over the idea that, you know, that it's unseemly to, you know, promote our own work. We have to be out there promoting it all the time. And I think that ebooks and the internet are a really good way of doing that.
Yeah, and you know, and I'm glad that you said that, because I believe that the ebook, especially for authors that write series, it's a great way to bridge gaps between books when people are saying, well, this is like 6 months ahead of time. What happened within the 6 months? And you can just kind of throw a little 40 to 60 page thing out there to kind of bridge that for them. And now the character becomes just a lot more alive, I guess you want to say. It's almost to the fact of, it's like they're memoirs. You're almost typing exactly like an autobiography. So I think it's a wonderful thing, and I love e-books, and I tell everybody I do, and everybody on that listens to the show know I love it. They're probably tired of me hearing say it, but that's too bad. It's my show. And
no,
and
you're right. You're right, John. And that's exactly what I couldn't even remember the name of the ebook that I wrote because I'm writing a lot of different things right now. The one that I wrote is called Silent Stalker, and it's a little longer. As I said, I think it's closer to 80 pages. But it's exactly what you're describing. It bridges some gaps, and it also has a couple of big reveals. About the backstory of my character, who has a missing father and a missing sister, missing for different reasons. But my editor said, you know, we need a reveal, and so I'm giving a big reveal in Silent Stalker as to what happened to his father and where his father is. And I think you're right. They really make, it's a real opportunity. You have to view it as an opportunity, right?
Absolutely. Well, I want to tell you what, C. E. Lawrence, thank you so much for coming on. Everybody, the website, celawrence.com, check out Silent Kills, Silent Screams, Silent Slaughter's coming.
Thank you.
You know, you have Silent Stalker coming.
And I also just want to mention very quickly, I also have a story in the new anthology, the MWA anthology edited by Lee Child called Vengeance. I have a story in that, and it's called Silent Justice.
and that's on Amazon and everything else for people to find.
Right. MWA, of course, Mystery Writers of America. It's their anthology, and it just came out. We just had a launch party for it like a month ago. So I feel like I should just give in a quick plug for that as well.
Yeah.
There's 21 authors represented, and I was lucky enough to be one of them. So.
Well, that's a great accomplishment, C. We want to thank you so much for coming on, and we want to recommend everybody to stick here with the series and get involved, especially if you like to be scared to death. That's the great part.
Yes.
Because guess what?
You can count on a scene in a cabin coming up shortly where someone wakes up in the middle of the night and who knows what's at the door.
Exactly. So, again, thank you, CE. You enjoy yourself. Have a great day. And, you know, we will talk with you soon. Stay in touch when the next book maybe comes out in the series. Love to have you on just to kind of see how everything's progressed and continuing.
Thank you. Thank you so much, John. I really appreciate it.
All right. Bye-bye. So, again, everybody, that is author C.E. Lawrence. The book, like I said, Silent Kills. You have Silent Screams. You have Silent Slaughter coming out. She definitely is not silent when she writes. So it's something that you want to make sure that you check out, celawrence.com. We're going to listen to another quick audio clip here. This is Istanbul Puzzle. This is by Lawrence O'Brien. And we're going to be then back on with our next guest, P.M. Terrell. So, here you go.
The Istanbul Puzzle by Lawrence O'Brien, Chapter 1, read by the author. I see sweat stream from Alex's pores. He'd been optimistic, way too optimistic. Kidnapping in the Islamic world was almost always a form of extortion, so he'd been told. But the appearance of the knife, big enough to gut a bear, had changed everything. He shook his head in disbelief. Only an hour ago he'd been happy in his hotel room, a place that was now as unreachable as a childhood dream. His heart banged against his ribs, as if it wanted out. He looked around. Was there someone else in the pillared hall he could appeal to? The bead-like eye of the video camera blinked on. Alex's arms and legs jerked, straining at the orange nylon rope binding him to the smooth pillar. Musty air filled his nostrils. He was trembling, as if he had a fever. When the two men had entered his room, he'd gone with them quietly. How stupid he'd been. Why hadn't he shouted, roared, jumped for the window? He'd seen the look in this bastard's eyes, as hard as stone. Now it was too late. "Let me go!" he screamed. His voice echoed. A hand held his shoulder. He threw his head from side to side, straining his neck. The rope around his ankles, knees, and chest held him tight. His pulse thumped against it. The knife glistened in the air like falling water. Only the prayer his mother had taught him could help him now. Agios Othias, Agios Osarkos, Agios Athantos, Ilios Anamas. Holy God, holy and mighty, holy and immortal, have mercy on us. He closed his eyes. Iciness hit his neck. Then a hot torrent fell on his chest. Warmth gushed down his legs, soaking him. A foul smell rose around him, and an eerie calm descended. He looked around the ancient hall, taking in its forest-like rows of pillars. The entrance he'd found must have been sealed up over 500 years ago, before the ancient city of Constantinople above him fell to a Muslim army, and its name was changed to Istanbul. There were treasures down here any museum director in the world would beg for, but he wished he'd never found the place. He stared at the aluminium tables nearby. What he'd seen on those tables had terrified him. A black mist rushed towards him. Would Sean find out what had happened? Agios Athias, Agios. A minute later, the two fountains of blood, 2 foot high at their peak, from the left and right arteries emerging from Alex's chest, bubbled like cooling coffee percolators. The flesh around them shone with a silky gleam. But Alex's eyes were closed, and his face was peaceful. I hope you enjoyed the rest of the book. The Jerusalem puzzle will be released January the 17th, 2013.
Welcome back, everybody, here starting the second hour of the 100th show of Suspense Radio. You just listened to Istanbul Puzzle by Lawrence O'Brien. We just had guest C.E. Lawrence on. She was talking about her, I guess you want to say, silent series, since everything has silence in the title. Before that, we had Alicia Singleton on and talked about her book, Dark Side of Valor. So starting here in the second hour, we are going to be joined by our next guest, which is author P.M. Terrell. And P.M., we would love to thank you so much for coming to the show today. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me on your show, John.
So your book, latest novel, which was just released in March 2012, was called Vicky's Key.
Uh-huh.
And that just came out. And everybody, again, the website is P.M. Terrell, that's 2 R's and 2 L's.com. So make sure you get that right. So the book Vicky's Key, you kind of mentioned it, it's a botched CIA mission. Vicky Boyd leaves the CIA, trying to start over. Some romance comes in, and then she kind of gets pulled back in. What's going on in Vicky's Key and poor Vicky? What did you do to her?
I you know what? I put my characters through the ringer. I admit it. The book actually does start out with her botched CIA mission, which becomes known as the Amazon Incident. And because of that, she decides that she wants to leave. And she moves to a new town, Lumberton, North Carolina, and decides to start over. And she takes a job working for an elderly lady. But when she arrives, she finds out that the lady has suffered a stroke and is confined to her third-story bedroom, and her Irish nephew has arrived to take care of her. So Vicky is pulled into the secrets of this house, and everything that that she thinks is going on, it really turns out to be something else entirely. And at the same time, the CIA find her again and tell her that they need to pull her back in for one last mission. So her future in this new house, in this new town, and her past with the CIA end up colliding in murder.
Now, your first book, Kickback, was published back in 2002. You've written a bunch of standalones. Is this something that you decided that you were going to be standalone? Did you ever think about writing a series? Do you have a character? Is Vicky going to be the one that gets you to write the series? Do you get a lot of emails about that?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, people have been begging me for years to do a series. And when I wrote Exit 22 a couple of years ago, everyone was asking what happened to the characters in that book. They wanted to see them continue. And the reason that I hadn't done a series in the past is I was worried about becoming a formula writer, and I didn't want people to get each book in the series and know exactly what's going to happen and when. But when I stumbled upon the real psychic program, which is in use by the CIA and the Department of Defense and others, I decided that that was the character that I needed that could get me anywhere I needed to be around the world in all different types of situations, local, international intrigue. So, yes, this is a series. And it's called Black Swamp Mysteries. It's actually named after the Lumber River is known as the Blackwater River. And that's
okay.
Where the company Blackwater got their name. And we didn't want it to be confused, so we named it Black Swamp Mysteries. And I've got another book in the series coming out this fall and then another one coming out next spring, all in the same series.
So it was something that kind of spurred you, maybe your fans kind of helped you along a little bit that you decided. I do understand about the formula writing because it is something that is very difficult to get out of that you see a lot of, I think, in thriller and suspense today where some authors, after they start writing their characters for a while, it almost is like the same book over and over and over and over again, and people don't want to do that, and standalones are much different. But you do have the fans that don't like to have those questions unanswered, and they want to know what's going on. So have you decided that you're going to have so much fun doing this that you might consider one of your past books, having some of your characters in that show up in the series? Because like I said, you have a lot of options that are going on. Have you kind of started working all those things together?
I have. In fact, the characters from Exit 22 actually merge with the characters in Vicky's Key. And moving forward, there's going to be about six main characters. And depending on the plot and what I have happening to each of them, one will come more to the forefront than the others. It's almost like an ensemble cast. You know, like if you look at something, say, like True Blood, you know, where you've got Sookie Stackhouse, but you've also got the other characters, and each one of those kind of moves to the forefront or to the background depending on what's going on, and that's the way that this series will end up being.
And I think that that's a very interesting approach where one character doesn't have, I guess you want to say, basically all the screen time. And you have to sit while you're writing, which is also a very daunting task because you have, it's almost going to be like you have one computer with seven different screens that you're going to have to kind of look at all these different characters and kind of try to put them all together to get them to all fit in there. And that's quite a challenge that you're taking on.
Well, it is, but my background before I started writing was very analytical, and I love puzzles. And to me, each of these characters is putting pieces into the puzzle, and each one is totally unique. For example, Vicky Boyd is the good girl. She lives inside the box. You know, she always colors inside the lines. But her sister, Brenda, who is actually one of the main characters in Exit 22, is exactly the opposite. And if they were not related, they wouldn't be friends, because Vicky would be totally disjointed by Brenda living on the wrong side of the law and always having to cross that line. But as sisters, they are stuck together their whole lives. And I've got characters that are intertwined like that, and they play off of each other. And I think it gives a really good balance to the whole book, because you don't fall into, the reader doesn't fall into the formula of the good girl getting into all of these different predicaments. And, you know, I mean, how many murders can there be in one small town?
I don't know. I'm Jessica Fletcher in Cabot Cove.
I know. That's exactly what I thought.
After 12 seasons, that population went from 5,000 down to 4,000 because she had everybody killed.
Well, this one I get a lot of leeway with, because especially with the psychic spy program, I can get Vicky into areas around the world that would be completely implausible, you know, if she was a physical operative on the ground. But as a psychic spy, it just opens up immeasurable opportunities.
Well, I want to remind everybody that we're talking with author P.M. Terrell. And the latest book is Vicky's Key, was released March 2012, which is now, you know, part of the series. You can be able to go out and get that wherever books are sold. Now, the one thing that is intriguing, because I've talked to a lot of authors who've written CIAs and FBIs, but I've never heard of this psychic, I guess you want to say psychic department, how you're calling it. What exactly is that? I'd like to talk a little more about that, because I have never heard this before, and I'm getting a little intrigued exactly about what it is and how it's utilized within the government organizations.
Well, there's actually been a lot of declassified information about it in the last 10 years or so, and basically what our government calls it is remote viewing. And during the Cold War, our United States intelligence departments picked up information that the Soviet Union had started this psychic spy program. The theory was that the Soviets wanted to know if they could use a psychic to actually infiltrate, say, our nuclear facilities and draw maps of all of our warheads, or sit in one of our planes and tell them exactly what all the instruments do and how the technology works, or even sit in on one of our highest level cabinet meetings. Well, the United States government, when they were reviewing this information, the intelligence community said that they didn't know whether there was anything to this psychic stuff. It could just be all, you know, hocus pocus and, you know, mirrors. But they didn't want to get down the road 20 or 30 years from now, find out that it is possible, and not only is it possible, but the Soviets are actually doing it. So they created their own psychic program here to study it, and there have been some tremendous supporters of it. In fact, Jimmy Carter actually used it during his administration. That's how they knew, one of the ways that they knew that the hostages were being kept together in Iran and when they were being separated. Just recently, a psychic spy was used to help determine the area that Saddam Hussein was hiding in, and that was one of the components that helped to lead to his capture. So it's something that's been in our government for several decades now.
Wow. I just never, I guess, went back research, but I never knew that was a legitimate existence, that we actually used that. And I have to say that was, you know, I could under, and especially using it when in such a way like the hostage situation, because I remember I was about 10 years old and all that stuff was going on, and the Cold War was just a very scary time. And it's great to be able to, I guess, explore those in your writing. So that has to just make it that much more interesting while you're researching.
It really does. And I've noticed with Vicky's Key, you really don't have to even believe in psychics or in the psychic spy program to enjoy the read, because it puts you into different scenarios around the world. In Vicky's Key, she actually has an assignment that takes her to a remote village in Afghanistan. But if you do know about the psychic program and you've, you know, researched it a bit, it's really fascinating. I was actually able to interview some of the people that have since retired, you know, about their experience. So what I write in Vicky's Key, the exact procedure that she goes through and the side effects that she suffers as well, are all part of this extensive research.
Now, you said your background was in analytics. So what intrigued you so much to dive into FBI, CIA kind of spy stuff in order to create your books that you've been writing now for, you know, over 10 years?
Well, actually, I always wanted to be a writer, but I fell into computers back in the 1970s. And as a result, I created two computer businesses in the Washington, D.C. area, and the CIA, the Secret Service, and the Department of Defense were some of my clients. My father is a retired FBI agent, So I grew up in an FBI household. So what I started off doing with Kickback about 10 years ago is having a computer expert that works for the FBI. In Exit 22, I went to the other side, and Brenda Carnegie, the main character, is actually a computer hacker, which is on the dark side. And now I'm fusing it all together, you know, into my background with what I did with the CIA and the Secret Service and intelligence. My specialty was in computer intelligence and white-collar computer crime. And I also worked a bit with local law enforcement agencies as well.
Wow. Now, see, that's the fascinating part that a lot of authors or a lot of readers just probably don't get is how somebody, you know, like yourself, ends up writing about FBI, CIA when it's like, oh, well, she's not an agent or she's never been, but your whole life has been surrounded by this whole entity. It was inevitable that that's what you were going to do. It was almost preset destiny.
I think so. And I've asked my dad so many times. He has so many fascinating stories with the FBI, you know, all the way from the 60s during the Civil Rights Movement. He actually went into the FBI in the 1950s, and he won't ever write about any of his cases, but he does tell me different stories here and there, and they actually make it into my books.
And now when you hear a story, and again, we're talking here with author P.M. Terrell, and her latest book here is Vicky's Key, pmterrell.com, two R's, two L's is the website. So when you're talking with your father and he's telling you these stories, how many times have you sat there and said, Dad, that didn't happen? That there's no way that could be true. There have to be stories like that you're like, there's no way that's right.
Well, you know, truth is stranger than fiction.
Absolutely.
And I know, and my dad is not a creative type. He's very analytical. So I know that when he's telling me what happened, that it's absolutely the truth. In fact, he was telling me one story that made it into a book that was published a year ago called The Banker's Greed. He had a call on a fugitive that he had been hunting for quite some time. And when the call came in, it was that he was in this particular vehicle. He had kidnapped a family, murdered them out in California, and they had expected him to go back to the Mississippi Delta where he had some friends. So when Dad finally found the car, it was the guy tried to burn it. He was no longer in it. It was out in the middle of a cotton field, and he had tried to burn it. Well, they dusted everything, and they couldn't get a fingerprint anywhere. And my dad said that he sat down in the driver's seat, and the sun was shining so brightly into his face. And he looked up at the sun visor, and he thought, bingo. They dusted the sun visor on the flip side, and sure enough, the guy had put his thumb up there to pull the visor down. When he cleaned the car of fingerprints, he never cleaned the visor. That one thumbprint is what they had to link him to the murders in California.
Wow.
And that made it into The Banker's Greed.
See, those are the fascinating stories to that when you do read those in the books, people are like, wow, what a fascinating imagination the author has, and this and that. You're like, yeah, well, I can't take credit, but I'm going to. That it was actually true. And it's just those little things. See, it's those little things that you guys are able to create that sets you apart from authors that are trying to get it and authors like yourself that have gotten it and able to understand what the readers really like and what makes that writing just that much different than someone who's just trying to throw their book out there right now and self-publish without really knowing how to create a story.
You're right. In fact, a couple of years ago, I was serving on a panel discussion, and one of the authors on the panel said that he had never done 5 minutes of research, and he was always getting letters from fans talking about how he had this FBI theme, and none of the things that he wrote were even possible, you know, or plausible in the FBI. And his answer was always, it's fiction. Well, I don't believe in that, and especially because of my background, I have a lot of law enforcement fans. And my feeling is that if they read something that isn't possible or even plausible, I have just lost credibility. And once a writer loses their credibility, it is next to impossible to get it back.
Absolutely. I agree with that 100%. I try to tell authors, look, if you're learning how to write and you want to start writing, the first thing you need to do to find your voice, write about what you know. Don't write about what you like or what you've read. Don't try to copy a Stephen King or a Dean Koontz or a John Saul or somebody like that. Write about what you know and create a story around that, because you're going to make your characters and your story much more believable, and especially when people are going to your website and finding out your bio. If you're going to write a medical thriller and you say, yeah, I've been a nurse for 15 years, you're going to have a sense of credibility instead of saying, yeah, I've been a nurse for 15 years and I'm writing this legal thriller. They're going to be like, well, why are you writing a legal thriller? You don't have no, you have no law background. So you're going to miss things, and then people are going to pick it apart because fans are fickle.
You're right. And I thoroughly believe in that, and I research like crazy. And when I am done with my my book, and I've edited it, you know, a zillion times, I will actually take chapters or scenes that have to do with, say, technology or the FBI or CIA, and I will send it to the experts, and I will ask them to read through that and let me know if I was right on the target with it, and if not, what I needed to do differently. When I wrote Ricochet a few years ago, I actually interviewed people who went through the FBI Academy, and I especially wanted to interview the female cadets for the same reason. I'm just a real stickler for those details. So when you read my book, you know that everything that I'm putting in there is plausible.
So kind of off subject of books a little bit now, what's on your DVR? What are you watching on TV?
You know what? You're going to think I'm crazy. I was watching Leap Year.
Oh, I never think authors are crazy.
I was watching Leap Year because I write so many, you know, murders and everything that I actually need something that is lighter. So right. I go more for, like, romantic light comedies as a way for me to relax.
You know what I do? I watch cartoons.
Do you? Okay, now
I love
better.
Yeah, I love cartoons. I love to watch the old Looney Tunes. We were just, in fact, there was a friend of mine yesterday. We were just sitting there talking. We were looking up old Seven cartoons. We found, like, the Funky Phantom and Captain Caveman and all those kinds of things. That's kind of, and so I just love cartoons. I love Batman and I love comics. I guess that's kind of my way to kind of get out of it, because when you're writing or you're reading a lot of, you know, let's just face it, it's death and scary and different things like that. You definitely need to kind of detoxify yourself, and you got to have something else that you're doing. So if you're a fan and you're reading a lot of thrillers, maybe you jump on a comic book, maybe you jump on a romance or something to kind of get your mind kind of out of that, because you don't want everything to kind of work and mesh together, I guess, too. Same thing as an author.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah, in fact, I just finished a whole series by Aaron Quinn, who they're kind of mysteries, but they're set in a time travel type of thing. And it was the same thing, is because I'm writing murders and procedural things day after day, I wanted something that takes me out of that box, something entirely different.
Oh, I mean, I absolutely agree 100% with all of that. And I just hope that the authors that are coming up, the ones that are going to take the reins in the future to kind of see what goes on, that they take a lot of what the authors today were are kind of letting them know, because you guys are paving the way for what books could end up being like in 20, 30 years. Now, the way that they're published might be different, but that has nothing to do, and that's the one thing I think that people need to get off of. Just because a book is an e-book or it's a printed book, the way that it's published or the medium that you're reading it in has nothing to do with the writing in the book. And that's the thing that has stayed true. So everyone who says, oh, I hate e-books, and I like to read books, and I got to hold the paper, the stories have never changed. Just because you're reading it in a different medium doesn't change anything like that.
That's true. And, you know, you said something earlier in the last hour that I totally agree with. I also love e-books. Absolutely love them. And for an author, it means that your books will never go out of print. For readers, I think maybe our children or our children's children, you know, they'll be completely on e-books. I think
and
it's fabulous.
And, you know, one thing people need to realize is e-books, which is I found out, if you go onto Amazon and you type in public domain books, you're going to find those classics, those Treasure Island, some Agatha Christie, some of those older books that are free because they're public domain. You can't go in and find them in bookstores. Barnes & Noble is going to sell them to you. But on ebook, you can have them for free, and you can read all of those old classics and all of those books that you're supposed to, you know, that people love, and they're right there at your fingertips now.
I think it's amazing. It's fascinating, and I love that technology.
Yeah. Well, I want to tell you what. It has been fascinating having you on, author P.M. Terrell. Like we said, the book is Vicky's Key. Your website is pmterrell.com. Came out March 2012, so it's available, so anyone can go get it. And I want to thank you so much for coming on with us, and we'd love to keep up on the series. Congratulations, and I forgot to say, on your nominee for 2012 International Book Award and a nominee for 2012 U.S. Best Book Award. So congratulations on that.
Thank you very much, and thank you so much for having me on your show today.
Well, I appreciate it, and thank you so much. And like I said, keep us up to date, and we'd love to chat when the next book comes out in the series to kind of see how much fun you're having, because it is something new to you and kind of how everything's progressing.
Okay, wonderful. I'd love to come back.
All right. Have a good day.
You too.
So, again, everybody, that is author P.M. Terrell, and the book is Vicky's Key, pmterrell.com. Go out, research it, the first one in the series, so you can't sit there and say, oh, there's too many books in the series and I can't read them because there's too many. No, this is number one. It's like that number one comic, that first one that you got. The number one coming out, bam, here you go, off and running. Go check out P.M. Terrell and Vicky's Key. Our 100th show is coming to an end. We have a half hour left. We're going to be joined with our last guest, who's going to wrap it all up for us here. Nancy Atherton, and her book, which is Welcome to Aunt Dipney's World. And you can find, you're going to be able to find her website and be able to talk with her coming here in just a second. First, we're going to play this for you because it is our 100th show, and I like to play music. And I'm just trying to figure out which song to play, so I'm just going to go ahead and we're just going to rock it out with this. Here you go. welcome back, everybody, again, our 100th show of Suspense Radio. I'm your host, John Robb. We have been able to be blessed. I want to just say again, thank you to Alicia Singleton for coming on to talk about her book, Dark Side of Valor. Thank you for C.E. Lawrence to come on and talk about her books. The Silent Series is what I'm going to call it because everything's silent in it, and CELawrence.com. And then you just sat there, and we just heard from P.M. Terrell and her latest book, Vicky's Key. Our next guest, and she told me off air that I made a mistake, and I didn't want to make the mistake. I meant to say that her books are in Aunt Dibny's World. That's not the name of the book. The name of the book is actually Aunt Dibny, or Dimity, probably. Dimity, you know I can't pronounce stuff. Aunt Dimity and the Village Witch. Mystery writer Nancy Atherton. The website is aunt-dimity.com. So that's where you want to go to find everything out about her. So, Nancy, we want to thank you so much for coming on. How you doing?
Hey, John. I am so happy to be here. It's such a gloomy day where I am here in Colorado. I'm not used to it, so I need some of your energy to get my batteries charged, you know? I mean, it's a little unusual. I'm used to having sun all day.
Yeah, but, I mean, so, I don't know if it's gloomy because Tim Tebow is now gone and the state is just still in mourning or not.
I imagine that's a sports reference, right?
Yeah, just a little one.
No, I've been jogging in place to get my energy up, so I'm ready.
Well, it's 85. It's going to be 85 degrees here in sunny in Southern California. So if that helps you, hopefully some of that sun is going to move over your way in the next day or so. You just never know.
Well, that's
Colorado has weird weather.
We had that yesterday, but since it is Colorado, today we have a high of 41 and it's cloudy. So
wonderful.
Tomorrow will again
be
sunny. It's just never. I like it. It keeps you on your toes. It keeps you, you know, alert. You don't get lulled into a sense of complacency with Colorado weather. You always have to be ready for anything.
I mean, what a great place to be a mystery writer than the mystery weather of Colorado, and you wake up and you just don't know what's happening. Fabulous.
Yeah, exactly. Mystery weather is very well put. Yeah, yeah. It's very exciting. It's an adventure every day. But anyway, yes, I have to apologize for having my series with such a complicated name. If I'd done it right, I would have called her Aunt Jane or something, or maybe even Cousin Jane, because everybody pronounces cousin the same, but people pronounce aunt differently. There's aunt.
Right. Well, you know, it's difficult to change her now because, you know, you're well over, 10 books in the series now with The Village Witch, which you had the family tree last time, and it all started off with poor Aunt Dibny's death. But
if I'd called her by a different name, she wouldn't have responded anyway. So it's that's what she was born with, and that's what she replies to. Yeah, this
Absolutely.
Is number 17 in the series.
17,
amazing. It's incredible to me.
And you've reached 26 on the New York Times bestseller list. Look at that, Woo-hoo! Going strong.
That
so you're on an amazing journey. Yeah, you're just on this amazing journey.
It's a journey that just continues on and on. I have a shelf in my office with my own books on it because I need them for reference to make sure I get people's eyes the right color and things like that, details. And I remember walking in there and looking at it and realizing that I needed to start another shelf. And my first thought was, when did that happen? When did
Absolutely.
All those books happen? But it's been 20 years. The first book came out in 1992, so this is Aunt Dimity's 20th anniversary, which is another kind of gobsmacking realization. What happened to those 20 years? I guess I was writing for part of them.
I mean, you look back now, and it is. You just don't know where the time has gone. 17 books in, 20 years later, you know, Aunt Dimity is still rocking it, and you're still having a lot of fun writing it. And I guess that's the testament of what makes it so interesting to be able to, and I know it's a difficult thing to keep something up for 17 books, just for the simple fact that, you know, sometimes author gets complacent and they can kind of get bored writing about it. But mysteries are different. Mysteries are something when you're talking to Sherlock Holmes or you're talking to Agatha Christie or Carol Poirot and things like that, mysteries have the ability when you're writing the characters that they are timeless and they keep going because they're not, I guess you want to say, constantly like James Bond. It's much different than that.
Yeah, it is, and also, and your characters, your main characters, the characters that travel with you through the series, they're always bumping into new people, and so and you react differently depending on who you're with, and so you discover different sides of my regular characters when new characters step onto the stage with them, and also my characters change over time. I mean, people ask me very frequently, it's very common, where should I start? And I say, well, you can start with any book. But if you start in the middle, you will stop, and then you will go to the beginning. Because where you really should start is in the first book. Because in the later books, you can read each of them independently. They stand alone. But you'll get a lot more jokes if you've read them in order. Because characters refer to things that happened in the past. And also characters change. You know, they get older. Their kids grow up, and different situations present themselves. Because they're different people than they were at the beginning. So that's part of the fun for me. And I've never had any problem with keeping the energy or interest, my own energy or interest in the series, because my characters are just endlessly fascinating to me, I have to say. They keep me entertained, and that's all I ask from them.
So here's a question. Somebody's standing right now, and they're standing in, let's say, Barnes & Noble, and Aunt Dimney's Death, which is the first book, and they've sold out. Aunt Dimney and the Village Witch, the one that just came out, is sold out. But they got all of the 15 sitting there in front of you. They're going to call you on the phone. They're going to say, Nancy, I'm standing here. The first book and the last book of the series are not here, but all the other ones are here. Which one should I pick up and start with first?
I would probably say the second one. go back as far as... Actually, what I'd say is go to the customer service desk and ask them to order the first one for you, because they're very happy to do that. Very happy to do that. Yep. Or I'd invite them over and I'd give them a copy, because I have a few on hand. So I've talked people out of, not often, because most people will get both of them, but I've talked people out of getting the new hardcover in order, if they want to start the series. And I'll say, really, you're going to buy this one anyway, so you may just go right ahead and get it now. And then most of the time they listen and they'll get the first one, and I hear from them later on via email or snail mail, or if I meet them again on a book tour, they'll say, oh, you were so right. I'm so glad I started with the first one. Or
yeah, you're like,
I wish I'd started with the first one. So
yeah, you're like, well, you know, I am the author. I mean, I do know something a little bit about my own series.
Well, honestly, it's not even me knowing much, because my readers know my books so much better than I do, and that is just not a lie at all. But this is what I hear from my readers all the time, is that, you know, they suggest strongly that people start from the beginning. Because, again, you just get a lot more references and you understand the characters better if you have that foundation of, if you've gotten to know them as they're going along in their lives. And it is absolutely true that my readers know my books better than I do, because I don't reread my books once I finish them. I'm first of all, I'm already involved in the next book, so
yeah.
It's hard to divide my attention. And yet I have readers who will reread the entire series before the next book comes out. They're like a lot of people do with classic series, like the Harry Potter books. People would do that.
Right.
And people do that with – I hear from people all the time who, yes, okay, I've started because I'm getting ready for the next book to come out. And so they know my characters. They'll say, well, did you know you got this wrong? And I say, okay, sorry. Whoops.
Yeah, oops.
But they do. They know them a lot better than I do. And it's delightful. It's just delightful.
Now – is there one, when you're looking back here, and it's sometimes difficult, like you said, because it is 20 years and 17 books, but is there one villain that you tend to get more emails about than any of the other ones within your book? You don't have to say the name, but is there one within the books, like which book is the one that you get the most emails about, the villain, that they either just, it just reached them in some emotional level?
Oh, this is going to sound weird, but I don't really have villains in my books. I've never gotten an email about a villain. I get emails about things that happen to characters that people identify with. And also, it's more the general spirit of the books that I hear about. They're extremely gentle mysteries. Kirkus Reviews called them the coziest cozies of them all, and I would agree with that. I don't have there's not bloodletting. There's no horrible creep in an alley waiting to jump out at you. It's mostly the way I usually describe it is that there's more to mystery than murder, and there are other kinds of mysteries that I deal with. And they're complex and they're compelling, but they're just not gory because I'm way too impressionable to indulge in that sort of scene. But what I hear from almost all the time, you can go to my guest book anytime pretty much, and then the personal email I get is very, very moving about people who have been in terrible situations and for some reason they've found antimony, and that book has pulled them through. And it sounds saccharine and melodramatic, but if you could see the emails I get, you would just roll your eyes and say, good grief, that's amazing. Because I'm amazed every day. It's not me. It's the books that somehow find people and help them through rough times. And it's not so much a particular character as it is the sort of the spirit of the books that takes them through. I just heard from a young woman in Afghanistan who was just, she's got 3 more months to go in this particular tour. She's feeling miserable, and she was. She said she was seeing fine people undergoing terrible, terrible things, and it was just depressing her enormously. And she downloaded my books onto her Kindle and started rereading them, and it sort of bucked up her spirit and kind of gave her this faith and this strength that she can get through it. And boy, when you hear something like that, you just get real humble real quickly. Because I'm sitting here in my comfortable house and she's out there serving our country. And if my books can help in any way, I am profoundly humbled and pleased, obviously. So yeah, I don't get comments on villains because I don't have a whole lot of villains. And I don't get comments on specific characters so much as the general feeling of the
just
book.
The general overview, the tone of the book, I guess, and that it reached emotional way.
The world view that the books sort of hold pretty consistently. And they're very, very funny, too. I mean, I make myself laugh a lot. They're not sweet saccharine, you know, sermons or anything like that. They're I don't know what it is, honestly. You'd have to ask the people who are touched by them. But I know that I laugh about 20 times a page because my main character just cracks me up because she's so goofy and just touchingly puzzled by everything in the world pretty much. And she's very funny. So anyway.
And I want to remind everybody that we're speaking here with author Nancy Atherton, and her series is Aunt Dittany's, and it's Aunt Dittany's World. That the whole series is 17 books so far is consumed in 20 years. The latest book is Aunt Dittany and the Village Witch. The website is aunt-dittany.com, D-I-M-I-T-Y.com. So when we're sitting here going back and you're just all over and you're looking around and you just have to come up, you know, with the next, does it make it that easy when you're going for the next book? Now you got number 18 coming out. While you're, you know, continually progressing in the series, that you have those secondary characters that you're writing, and those are the ones that are probably a little more surprising to you in how they're, like, coming about. Do you have any kind of particular character that has progressed throughout the series that you've just felt has been kind of, like, fun and kind of surprising?
Pretty much, I think all of the characters have surprised me at one time or another. I have to say that the secondary characters are probably the characters who are not necessarily the ones who travel from book to book, but the ones who show up are frequently the most surprising, because in several cases, well, I'll tell you, in one book there's an extremely major character. He's not a regular character, but he appears in this book, and he's just second only to the lead character, okay? Mm-hmm. And I had no idea he was going to be in the book at all until my main character sort of looked over her shoulder and saw this man standing there in this leather jacket and jeans and wondered who he was. And I wondered, too. And then she sort of went out and they met, and he turned out to be this key character to the whole book. And I love it when that happens, when somebody just decides to come into the, actually, it's like the story already exists, and I'm discovering it as I'm writing it.
Right.
And this character always knew he was going to be in the story. He just didn't tell me about it until he showed up. And that is just a pleasure. And then I get to learn all about, well, as much as I can in the course of one book, about this character and what makes him tick, and what he likes, what he doesn't like, what his secrets are. Some of them,
they're
I don't
like,
always learn
like
all of them.
They kind of just start trespassing on your book, and they're like, all right, fine, if you're going to trespass, then you're going to start doing some damn work in here.
I'm the trespasser. No. I don't order my characters to do anything.
That character just kind of trespassed right into your story because you didn't know they were coming. Then all of a sudden they show up, and you're like, okay, well, if you're here now you're going to do some work. If you want to show up in the book, no?
No, that gives the illusion that I am in control of a story. The way you're putting it is that I'm going along writing my story, and all of a sudden this character butts in. No, what I'm doing is writing the story in which this character always was. I just didn't know about it until I got to that point. And he is gracious enough to allow me to tell the story that I didn't realize that was what the story was until he showed up. And then all of a sudden it's like, tell me more. Tell me more.
Okay.
I'm really interested. I tried the other thing with my second book. I thought I knew what the story was, and by gum, I was going to make my characters do what I thought they were supposed to do, and they just grabbed their marbles and walked away. I wouldn't play until I'd shut up and listen.
Huh.
And I learned very, very early on never to try to arm wrestle with my characters because they always win. And finally, I sort of tipped my ego and put it over on the side and gave up the illusion of control and just shut up, and I listened, and then the story moved on because they knew what the story was.
So as soon as you stop being stubborn, then you can finally write a book, Nancy, right?
Exactly.
There you go. That's the whole premise that we're trying to get. You stop being stubborn and just let her write the book. All you are is you're just the portal to get them to get out to everybody else, because they can't do that on their own. They have to use you.
It really, really does feel that way, that I am absolutely sort of the channeler of this energy from the universe, and that these stories have chosen me to tell them. It sounds mystic, Meg. It sounds goofy, but it just feels that way. It feels as though for whatever, because I had no plans to be a writer. This was all a big surprise to me. This 20 years later, what did I know?
What were you going to do?
I have no idea. I never knew what I wanted to be when I grew up. Uh-huh. I just worked all sorts of different jobs and traveled, and clearly I was collecting material, but I didn't know that at the time.
Right.
But I feel as though these characters sort of looked around and said, okay, you. And then they presented. Pardon me?
So they just kind of hit, there it is, boom. It's just, you're the one who's going to do it. And you're like, oh, okay.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for picking me. Appreciate that.
And it's exactly what I should be doing.
Yeah.
And I think if more people allowed themselves to listen to that weird impulse that doesn't make any sense, and yet, okay, I'll go with it, all of a sudden you realize that you have been chosen to do exactly what you're supposed to be doing, and you didn't know it. Yeah. I say thank you every day, because it really is such a gift. They say that writing is a gift, and it really has been for me. And at 20 years into it, I'm just as enthused and excited and delighted to be doing it as I was at the beginning. And I never know what's going to happen next.
And that's the fascinating part. So, I want to tell you what, Nancy, I want to thank you so much for coming on today and sharing, you know, the world of Aunt Bethany with us and, you know, your world and being able to share it with the readers. 20 years is just a mind-boggling accomplishment to be able to do something at the highest level for so long, 17 books in now, to the Aunt Bethany series. So I want to thank you so much for coming on. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me. This was a complete blast.
Well, it's been a complete blast here. Ending the 100th show is no better
Woo-hoo!
Way than here with Aunt Bethany and Nancy Atherton.
Okay, John. Thanks a bunch.
Thank you. You enjoy yourself. Hopefully the clouds will clear and
they will.
The weather will be nice, and then it'll go right back again.
And we need the moisture, we have to say. Wildfire season is starting, so I'm not complaining. And you give a lot of energy, and I'm grateful for that, so thanks.
Well, thank you so much again. So enjoy yourself, and we will, you know, stay in tune and see what you have coming up in the future, and we'll maybe connect again.
Yeah, let's do that. It's a date.
Fabulous. We'll see you then.
Okay, bye-bye, John.
All right, bye-bye. So, again, everybody, I was author Nancy Atherton, and her series is Aunt Bethany's World. The website is aunt-bitney.com, D-I-M-I-T-Y, to be able to see all of the stuff that she's created here in this world, 17 books, 20 years later. The latest book is Aunt Bethany and the Village Witch. It's been an amazing run here, 100 shows. It's now come to the end, and because we're going to be back here on June 16th. There might be another show scheduled in there. We're looking. There's some guests that we're trying to be able to fit in, but June 16th right now is our next scheduled show. It's going to have Alan Jacobson, Eric Van Lustbader, who you might know from writing right now the Bourne series, and of course Alan Jacobson. He wrote Inmate 1577 along with Philosophy and a lot of other books. Rick Reed is back. Good to have Rick. And then Bruce Holbrook. So it's going to be another two-hour show coming on June 16th. It's going to be live starting at 9:30 a.m., but you can always listen to the archives. You can download the podcast. You can find us everywhere. Like I said, we want to try to see. It would be fascinating to see if we could reach over 40,000 listeners at the end of the year. It would be great to go over that. Right now we're a little over 37,000. We continue to grow. We want to thank everybody. It's been, you know, like I said, an incredible journey. We love being able to bring the authors on to you and bring into your home. 2 hours later here on Suspense Radio, the 100th episode, if you have any questions, any comments, anybody you want to see on, anybody that you want to hear from, all you have to do is email editor@suspensemagazine.com and let us know. We will do what we can to get them on so you can hear your favorite authors on the show. If you have audio clips that you want to do, again, editor@suspensemagazine.com. Any question, anything at all, we are looking to help any authors in the genre, suspense, mystery, thriller, horror, the tangent ones that come all along with that, to get more fans, more readers, bring you in here to one place to talk about the genres and the authors that we love to read. Summertime's approaching, everybody. Make sure that you're out there and checking out your favorite authors. We just had 4 fabulous ones on today that can easily fill your Kindle and fill out your library, so you have no reason at night in the summer to not be reading, to have enjoyment going on all the way through up until when the holiday books start coming out and the new wave of everything is there. So until then, like I said, we will see you on June the 16th, but check out the website, suspensemagazine.com. Click on Suspense Radio to see everything. Like us on Facebook. You can find us there. Like us on Twitter. Or not like us on Twitter. Just listen to us on Twitter. And we keep everybody updated on everything that's going on. So again, everybody, I'm John Robb. It's been a blast. Thank you so much. And we will see you all June 16th. Here you go.